go, let's go, let's go. Tempo in and out of the huddle.
This is Patriots Playbook.
They're looking for man coverage in the zone. They didn't have anybody to throw to. Just stay outside on the seven route.
Patriots Playbook, breaking down last Sunday's game.
Yeah, go ahead and hit it in there because the backers are going to fast read over the top.
Next Sunday's game.
Want to go odd. 5.
Patriots Playbook.
51 mirror.
And the rest of the 2006 NFL season.
Sack, guts, combat. Odd. 51 mirror.
And some of the fun stuff in between.
Even. 51 grapes. Even. 51 grapes.
And now... he's John Rook.
Let's go, let's go.
We're moving right along. It is, of course, Wednesday here on Patriots Playbook and Patriots.com radio, which means we're another 24 hours closer to getting this AFC divisional game kicked off between the Patriots and the San Diego Chargers in San Diego this Sunday afternoon. We welcome you inside the playbook yet again. Some things to get to today in terms of some interviews we have for you. We'll hear from Patriots head coach Bill Belichick coming up in just a little bit. We'll also hear from Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. The conference calls with the opposing side, this, of course, being San Diego, because of the time difference, won't be posted in time for us to be able to get into them today. Hopefully that'll be a part of tomorrow's program, especially for those of you that are Patriots fans that are always interested in what the opposition has to say. It's one of the great features that I really like about this program every week is that we're able to bring it to you, and you can hear the actual questions from media so you can get the full context of what is being said and the question that's being asked. It's always good. Because when you read it online, or you read it in your newspaper, or you hear it on your radio, or you see it on television or ESPN or whatever your program of choice would be, you always get sound bites. You always get clips. You always get, you know, snippets. You always get quotes. You don't get the full context a lot of times of what is trying to be said and what is trying to be portrayed, not only by the reporter asking the question, but by the player responding to that very question. So that's one of the bonuses of the program that we have here is we can bring it to you in full. And we'll do that with Coach Belichick and with Tom Brady coming up in just a little bit here on the program. And we'll try to get the Chargers interviews for you tomorrow. We'll also today have for you the conference call that CBS Sports held with the game analysts for this weekend's AFC playoffs. Phil Sims will be with Jim Nance for the Patriots San Diego game. And Dan Dierdorf will be with Greg Gumbel for the Ravens and Colts game, and we'll let you hear how they break down these two AFC matchups, again, coming up in just a little bit here on the program. In the meantime, webradio at patriots.com. That's how you get us here. Email address, the same as PFW in progress, webradio at patriots.com. If you want to call in, please do so. Please pick up the phone. Let's chat. Let's talk a little football. Let's talk breakdowns. Let's talk edge. Let's talk matchup. Whatever is on your mind, 508-543-7482. And again, that number is 508-543-7482. Right off the top, I would like to ask you, both for Patriots fans and for those Charger fans that are listening, because we know that we have some of you. Several of you emailed yesterday. Obviously, a couple of you emailing again during the PFW in Progress show today. So it's wonderful that you're listening. We appreciate it, and you are welcome. Just that we happen to think probably differently about the outcome of the game than you do, but that's fine.
Go f*** yourself, San Diego.
Yeah, there you go. You've got that one to live down, I think, from Anchorman. Here's the thing. I think we all realize that there are certain keys to a ball game that your team, whether it's the Patriots or whether it's the Chargers, we're going to have to focus on in order to win the game on Sunday. So it's a really simple question for you today that I'm hoping you'll fire off an email to me too. Give me one must-do thing. Give me one thing that your team, whether it's the Pats or the Chargers, give me one thing that your team must do on Sunday in order to win the game. Now, I realize that there are probably several things. And you can get into all kind of X and O, and you can get into all kind of suppositions, you can get into all kind of breakdowns, and without getting terribly technical here, I want you to look at your teams, I want your opinion on their respective weaknesses and strengths going into this matchup. Because I really believe, and I mentioned this on yesterday's program, I really believe that the Super Bowl winner is going to come out of this game. I believe that strongly. Whoever wins this game on Sunday is the front runner for the game. And that's, again, with all due respect to the Ravens and the Colts playing in the other AFC game. And, yes, even though I think we all realize that the NFC was a stepsister to the AFC once again in the overall matchups between the leagues. You still, it's just one game. You still got to go out and play the game. And yes, if the AFC representative throws up a stinker, then the NFC team, whoever it might be, okay, well, you know, maybe not Seattle. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows who can put it together? Whoever it might be has a chance to win a game because it's just one game. It's not like you're playing a best of seven. It's one game. So, yeah, you've got a puncher's chance at the very least. But I think you'd have to admit that, yeah, the AFC champion, whoever it's going to be, is going to be a favorite in this thing. May even be a prohibitive favorite in this thing. Especially you're going to be playing in Miami, which is an AFC town. So, all of this being said, there's one thing that you can usually boil it down to that you think your team has to do in order to win a game. Sometimes it's just as simple as running the football. Sometimes it's just as simple as tackling. That is my one thing. The Patriots, and I have beat this drum until you can't beat it anymore, but I'm going to beat it again today. And I just did it with Paul, and I've done it throughout the entire season, especially the last half of the season as it has gotten progressively worse for the Patriots. But the Patriots must wrap up when they tackle on Sunday. That is my one thing for this Sunday, for the Pats to win the game. And again, yesterday, if you didn't hear the program, I picked the Chargers to win the game. My early week prognostication, my early week thinking was, is that the Chargers have an edge, and perhaps deservedly so at this stage. I'll be honest with you, and I mentioned this yesterday, and here we are 24 hours later. The more that I read, the more that I think about it, the more that I talk about it, the more that I listen to others talk about it, I haven't moved one bit yet. I have not edged toward the Patriots at all. And maybe that is a little bit disconcerting to Patriots fans. Chargers fans don't get all hot and bothered over that. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Chargers prove themselves to be the preeminent team throughout the course of the regular season, and I'm probably paying that a lot of attention and giving that a lot of respect right now. Fact is that Philip Rivers' numbers overall as quarterback were less in the last half of the season. They were lower than what they were in the first half. Maybe that's because teams adjusted to him, had a more of a chance to see him and study him and decide how to attack him. His passer rating, I think, over the last five, six games of the year was in the 70s. So with that having been said, I think we all realize that the Patriots certainly have at least a puncher's chance, you must admit, if not a better than puncher's chance, against San Diego. And you know that Bill Belichick and Dean Pease and the Patriots defense will come up with something to cause him, let's just say, to question what he's actually looking at out on the field. But when he does complete one to Antonio Gates, or when he does hit the wideouts and find Vincent Jackson and Keenan McCardell and Eric Parker and Azakim, if he's out there, and certainly Antonio Gates at tight end, or when he throws out of the backfield to Tomlinson, and when he does decide to go to the air, the Patriots must tackle because they are one of the worst tackling teams, certainly of the eight teams that are left in the NFL playoffs. This has been their Achilles heel over the last half of the season. They have been able to live through it, but they have been burned on big plays primarily defensively because of what, kids? Not tackling. Look at last week. Artrell Hawkins missed that tackle on Jericho Cotchery. He turned it into a 77-yarder for a touchdown, which is the longest touchdown play in Jets playoff history. Now, granted, it's not all that great, but still, it is what it is. So that concerns me a great deal. And, you know, if they decide that, you know, they don't want Gates to beat him, if they decide that they don't want LT to beat him or what have you, if they try to pin him inside and make him run, get his yardage between tackles, one of those two guys is going to get in the open field. One of those two guys is going to bust one at some point in time during the game. Now, the question is, does a 15 or a 20-yard play then become a 30 or 40 or even more? This is where tackling comes into play. The Patriots can keep that from becoming a big play if they wrap up. And I just don't know if they're completely capable of that. So that's my one thing. That's my number one concern. There are many others that you can choose from. There is no right or wrong answer here. That's the best part about it, is there's no right or wrong answer here. It's your opinion based on your observations of the game, based on your observations of what you've seen from your team, whether it's the Pats or the Chargers. It's got to be one significant detail that you're looking to in order to you think your team have a chance to win the football game. That's primarily where we are in terms of breaking this entire thing down. Webradio at Patriots.com, and we'll let you have your 2 cents worth on that here in just a couple of moments. In the meantime, we're going to ask that question of this gentleman, who I'm very pleased will take a couple of moments to join us here inside the playbook. Sean Salisbury, of course, you know, is a former NFL quarterback and currently an NFL analyst on ESPN, and he joined us here inside the playbook. Sean, it's great to visit with you. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes, buddy.
Johnny, always a pleasure, man. How are you?
I'm great. I'm doing well. Let me ask you this question, because this is what I just pointed out. We've gotten a lot of, as you might imagine, a lot of Chargers fans listening in this week as well.
Mm-hmm.
If there is one thing that you think either one of these teams has to do above all in order to win on Sunday, can you narrow it down to just one thing you think they need to do in order to win?
I could do it one for each team, but
okay.
I can tell you the one that, and then I'll give you the one that sticks out the most.
Go.
For the Chargers to win,
yep.
I believe they're going to have to deal. Phillip Rivers is going to have to deal with something he's never seen before. Now, you can talk about tape or if they played him. Is it? And he's been on the team when they played the Chargers. I mean, they played the Patriots before. And I know that sounds like, well, that's what do you mean he's going to have to deal with what they? Because Bill's going to give him something that's different. And even if he doesn't, even if it's not different, Bill will make it look different.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I'm saying.
Right.
And because I believe if you're Cam Cameron, the offensive coordinator for the Chargers, you must approach the game this way. Because here's exactly what I do, and I. You know how, John, when we're in this business, you study it more than when you played in it because you got 32 teams to deal with as opposed to just one opposing opponent.
Right.
You know, but for me, if you're Cam Cameron, you must assume going into this game because there's been no better coach in recent memory that's able to take the best player out of a team's game. And the best player on the field this year and maybe the best is Latanian Tomlinson.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're Cam Cameron, the coordinator of the Chargers, you must come into this game assuming – just assume that LT's taken out of the game because you got to hope for the best. That doesn't mean you'll call plays to him and don't, hey, if you're going to go down with the ship, go down giving that doggone, make sure the captain of it is getting a chance to paddle, and that's LaDainian Tomlinson. I don't mean change your game plan, but I mean you better have something to understand that if Bill Belichick takes him out and LT has 27 carries for 73 yards, then how else are we going to beat the Patriots?
Right.
Because that won't be good enough. So I'm going to say I got plays for LT, but if they take him away, I better have a backup plan.
Mm-hmm.
And my backup plan better be something that allows Phillip Rivers an understanding that I got to put him in position to win. That's number one. So they must find a way to deal with what's probably going to be Bill taking away that guy right there.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't, then you know what, he's human and everybody other, just like everybody else, nobody can stop LT.
Right.
But, and then on the other side, to me, it's pretty simple, and it's find a way. It's going to be easier said than done. But you got to stop Merriman from taking the game over
mm-hmm.
because he can. He's one of those defensive players in this league that'll dominate you. So whether that means we double team him, we chip him, that my tackle, and it's going to be right and left tackle and tight end. They're all going to have to be a part of this because Merriman will move around. They're not going to let him just the people know where he's lined up. Is that you better be able to contain him and not let him get one of those 3-sack, 2-fumble games. Those two things. And if I'm the Patriots, I make it a 4-man game, John, and I like the Patriots' chances if they get it to this. I want the game in the fourth quarter to be a two-man basketball game. It's Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade versus whoever else you want to put on there. It's Marty Schottenheimer against Bill Belichick, and it's Tom Brady against Phillip Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
If I can make it come down to those four people, I like the chances of the New England Patriots.
Yeah, I think that's what all Patriot fans right now, Sean, are hoping for, and I certainly understand the analogy. I guess my biggest problem is, and this is what I mentioned, what I think the Patriots have to do, one thing in order to do it well. The Patriots have not been all season long a good tackling team. They just, in terms of fundamentals, they are poor. And we saw it happen this last week again when Artrell Hawkins had Jericho Cotchery bounce off of him and go 77 yards. So the Patriots must wrap up. And it's going to be difficult because you know that at some point in time, LT is going to get into the open field. You know that at some point in time, a guy like Antonio Gates is going to get into the open field. Maybe even Jackson or McCardle or somebody else going to get down the field and get open. And the Patriots have got to keep a 20-yard play from becoming a 50 or more.
Well, there's no question, John. And then that goes along with that elementary back to the old Pop Warner days, get your head up, tackle. That's why the Colts want to make it seem like they discovered some miracle last week. The miracle was that they actually got in the hole. I saw guys wrap up, Booger McFarland tackling people, Bob Sanders on the team against Kansas City. They actually beat them to the punch, and when they got there, they made the play.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to tackling with your head down and trying to hit the big knockout hit and letting somebody miss you and go, Tomlinson will have a 15-yard run in the game.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And Gates will make a catch, and he may make a 20-yard catch. But number one, you got to limit those explosives, is what we call them, 20 plus yard plays. But you're right. If they don't tackle, they got no shot. I mean, LT will run, he'll go crazy. And we'll know by about the middle of the third quarter if they're tackling, because we'll say, oh my gosh, LT's got 15 carries for 113 yards and two touchdowns, and one of them was for 47. You'll know.
Yeah.
But if they're tackling well, which I'm just going to assume in a game of this magnitude that Belichick's team will be prepared to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then it comes down to the four-man game for me, and really a two-man game. It's the two coaches versus and the two quarterbacks. And if you get it to that, I don't know how anybody on the planet can't like Brady. Chargers are pretty good, though, and it's easier said than done containing Tomlinson and Sean Merriman. It will be a task and a task of will, not just scheme.
I would think that it would be it's going to be a very large challenge for Cam Cameron this week to see that Phillip Rivers has every opportunity to succeed, knowing that the Patriots are going to throw some wrinkles out there that he either A, hasn't seen, or B, doesn't have any experience with. And I wonder if you can play like that. I wonder if you can play for fear out of what the other guy might throw at you. How do you prepare someone for that?
Well, in your mind, you know going in that it'll happen. But I always believe in games like this, you do what you do best, and if you out-execute, you win. I don't think that Cam Cameron will say, you know, I'm going to outsmart Bill Belichick by, we're going to give now, you may want to formation him. What I always have believed is that I take a team's biggest strength on defense and try to turn it into a weakness. And let's assume that the strength of the Patriots on defense is their variety of looks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then you know what? I'll tell you how I can limit their variety of looks. Is I'm going to come out in three wides, and I'm going to flex Antonio Gates, and I'm going to keep LaDainian Tomlinson in the backfield, or I'll put two wide receivers, flex Gates, and keep Lorenzo Neal and LT in the backfield. Now I dictate your formation, because you can put nine guys in there, but then if you don't cover up the other three, then you got problems. So I think you got to play. I don't like passive football teams. I like smart football teams. I don't like passive football teams. I think Cam's got to tell Phillip that, listen, if there's a shot, you have to take it. We're not going to play scared, but we're not going to play stupid. I just don't think, because you're right, if you're playing to the point where you're saying, oh my gosh, is Bill going to do this? Well, I got to do this. I think you got to do, games like this are won by your staple plays. The Patriots, same way on offense. They're going to win by giving it to Maroney and Dillon, spreading out in a four wides, putting Tom in a gun, having Tom be accurate, run out cuts, curl routes, every now and then sneak a post over the top, and do that and hit the tight end. That's how they're going to win. They're not going to win by playing reverse pass, touchdown. So that's not their game. They're going to win by the nuts and bolts of what they do, and the Chargers are too. But it's a very difficult task when Bill Belichick, and it's an intimidating task, although coaches don't like to admit that somebody else may get into their head. It is Bill Belichick, and he's done it so many times before. It's not just intimidation. It's the fact that he's good at it. So I'm having a hard time with this game, John, as far as how to pick it, because I know if it gets down to the quarterback, I know where I'm going, but Tomlinson and Merriman are so good, and the Patriots are so good on the road too.
Mm-hmm.
Experience has some. That's why I'm waiting until the end of the week before I give a pick. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like you're kind of tussling with it. I'll be honest with you. Right off the bat, I'm favoring San Diego because the reason I am is because I think that they can put enough pressure on Brady. And, of course, we've seen what pressure can do to Brady. And the Patriots' offensive line has been susceptible at times, although when you spread it out and you put him in the gun, he's been less susceptible. So I would certainly expect the Patriots to come out and, you know, in three and four wide and putting him in the backfield.
Remember
like
what they did against the Vikings, John?
Yes, yes.
Where they spread him out and they didn't play up to Kevin and Williams and Pat Williams and The Chargers' strength is keeping Merriman close to the line of scrimmage and rushing the passer. He's not a great cover guy. and Jamal Williams stuffing the run and putting you in long yarded situations, and then they tee off.
And I
running out of the gun can happen. You can do that. Kevin Falk out of the backfield, you can do that. You know, you mix it in. I fully expect, in order to see those blitzes and see the pressure, I fully expect Tom to be in the gun a lot and away from the line of scrimmage, and giving him an opportunity to make, to even if this guy doesn't block the blitz properly, giving Tom an opportunity to throw it away. I think that's what San Diego is going to have to deal with. I think he'd be making a big mistake if you keep it bunched and play, you know, two tight ends and on a regular basis. I'm talking about that you're playing a run formation and you let in your passing situation, because there's no single guy. I don't care who the tackle is or tight end. Ben Watson, they can't stop Merriman for four quarters.
Yeah.
He, on one-on-one, he's just too good.
Yeah.
He's just too good. So I think it's an intriguing game, and if I had to buy one ticket for a game this weekend, it would be this one, because I think there's so many stars in it, but there's also going to be somebody who's not a star like Gaffney last week who will play well and make a difference in this game.
What kind of programming are you on this week that we can look for?
Oh, the question is what I'm not on. just NFL Live, you know, Sports Center all week, and be back doing Sports Center on the weekends and do Sports Center tonight. I don't know if John Clayton's in town. Normally we do four downs on Wednesday for Sports Center, so turn it on, and you'll get sick of seeing me. I'm already sick of it too, but I love my job.
Of course you do. It's that time of year. You got to love
sir.
It, right? Thank you, Sean, for spending
Johnny,
a couple of minutes.
Great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on, and good luck to those Patriots this week.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. That's Sean Salisbury, who's of course the NFL analyst for ESPN, former NFL quarterback, and he promised he'd give us a few minutes during playoff time. And by golly, there you go. So you got the lowdown from Sean Salisbury. It's good stuff.
It only took us 2 years.
Yeah, it's always like we're always picking them up. Oh, geez, I forgot about you guys this week. All right, hit me up again next week. We hit him up again next week. Oh, geez, I forgot about you guys. So anyway. And last time I was on campus in Bristol, it's kind of like, when are we going to get together and do that Patriots thing for you? And I kind of look at him like, Sean, hello. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's on me, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay, give me a call. So, hey, it worked today. Woohoo! There we go. All right, there's some initial thoughts, at least, on how I think the game can break down, how Sean Salisbury thinks the game is going to break down. And I want to hear from you now. This show's for you. It's about you, and it's about your thoughts and what you think will transpire. Give me one thing that you think your team, Pats and Chargers alike, that you think your team needs to accomplish in order to win the game on Sunday. Webradio at Patriots.com, 508-543-7482. That's our telephone number. We're going to sneak a timeout in here. We'll come back and do some emails. Got some other numbers to pass on to you. We'll hear from Tom Brady today. We'll hear from Bill Belichick today. And we'll also hear from Phil Sims and Dan Dierdorf on conference call today, right here inside the playbook.
Extra tackle, drive to the field, to the 10, to the 5.
From a first-round draft pick in 2004 to owning the longest touchdown reception in Patriots playoff history, Benjamin Watson has become a standout for the three-time Super Bowl champs.
One of the best I've ever seen.
Now you can get an official mini replica helmet exclusively from the New England Patriots signed by Benjamin Watson free. This authentic mini helmet comes complete with a chin strap, receiver face mask, and Ben Watson's autograph. All you need to do is make qualifying transactions on your Bank of America Patriots Extra Points Visa card. Plus, with your card, you'll earn Patriots Extra Points, redeemable for once-in-a-lifetime Patriots experiences, tickets, and much more. Don't wait. Apply at PatriotsExtraPoints.com or call 1-800-NFL-9929 to get your Patriots Extra Points Visa card and a free official mini replica helmet autographed by Benjamin Watson. Patriots Extra Points, because fans want contact too. Autographed mini helmet limited to your first 400 with qualifying purchase. See details at PatriotsExtraPoints.com.
Bank of America would like to take a moment to let you hear what our home equity line of credit sounds like. You see, if you want to remodel the kitchen...
It smells great, hon.
Or renovate the bathroom.
Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my...
Or fix up anything around the house, Bank of America's home equity line of credit is the easy, low-cost way to make it all happen. There's no paperwork to bring, so applying is simple. And you'll have access to your money just about everywhere, by phone, online, and at our banking centers nationwide. All of which makes putting that pool in the backyard... a little less of a dream and a little more of a reality. So whether you want to have the pros handle it or do it yourself, a Bank of America home equity line of credit is your ticket. Apply today. Just visit bankofamerica.com, call 1-800-900-9000, or stop by your neighborhood banking center.
Clementine.
Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Bank of America. Higher standards. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
Let's go and jump right in. Come on.
It's here at your local Ford store. Comprehensive coverage on every vehicle we sell. That's right, Ford stands behind every 2006 model with a 5-year, 60,000-mile powertrain extended service contract at no extra charge. Every Mustang, every 500, every Freestyle, every Explorer, even every F-Series truck. Every new 2006 Ford vehicle comes with a 5-year, 60,000-mile powertrain extended service contract at no extra charge. That's security. Plus, right now you can get 0% financing on select Fords, 560 coverage, 0% financing. At Ford, we're with you every step of the way. See your local Ford store or call 1-877-4410. Ford, bold moves.
Come on, baby, let's go.
On for a Wednesday here on Patriots.com Radio. I'm John Rook. Web radio at Patriots.com is how you reach the program. 508-543-7482. That's our telephone number. Bill Belichick coming up in just a couple of moments. In the meantime, I don't know if you saw this story. There was a story in the Boston Globe talking about how, and we mentioned this actually on yesterday's show. We did. We mentioned it yesterday how we got an email from a fan who said that they were under the impression that there were tickets available for this playoff game in San Diego, and we were kind of like, well, it's pretty tough for us to imagine that because we've had almost, what, 140 consecutive sellouts here in Foxborough, but that there were tickets actually available via, what, Ticketmaster, I think, in San Diego for this Sunday's game, and that's just, like, unfathomable around here. Well, apparently, there's a report in the Boston Globe that says that the Chargers, the reason that this was the case, these tickets could have sold out a long time ago. But the Chargers have restricted sales to the divisional playoff game to residents of Southern California only.
Go f*** yourself, San Diego.
Yeah, residency will be based on the credit card billing address. Orders by residents outside of Southern California will be canceled without notice. How about that? So there you go. That's why there were tickets available. And, of course, now apparently there are not. If you go through Ticketmaster now, I believe the game is a sellout, so it doesn't surprise me. But the reason that we learned this is because there were several Patriots fans who actually went looking for game tickets. Ticketmaster basically announced that this is what the deal was, that they're restricting, or that the Chargers themselves, not Ticketmaster, but the Chargers were restricting sales of the tickets to residents of Southern California and the surrounding area only. Kind of interesting, huh? By the way, just as an aside, did you notice how many Jets fans were here in Foxborough at Gillette Stadium for the game this past Sunday? There were thousands of Jets fans. In fact, I do not remember a game, certainly in now the 5-year history of Gillette Stadium, I do not remember a home game with as many opposing fans as there were this past Sunday with the Jets playing the Patriots. Now, certainly proximity has something to do with that, I know. The fact that it's the Jets, a divisional rival, has another something to do with it. But what it also tells me is that somehow, some way, these Jets fans were getting the tickets. And hey, for a franchise that has sold out now, what, Gary, 138, I think it is now? 138 consecutive games, and that includes, shall I say, that includes the preseason, kids. Okay, includes the preseason. Somehow these Jets fans are still getting tickets, and yet the Charger fans want to keep that home field advantage. They're scared of the big bad Patriots coming in and taking over their field.
Go f*** yourself, San Diego.
How about that? I just think that that is an absolutely classless thing to do. Hey, it's more bulletin board material. I mean, I understand why they did it. I don't think it's the right thing to do. I think, you know, hey, a buck is a buck. A ticket sold is a ticket sold. If you really think that a few measly 1,000 tickets or 100 tickets, as the case may be, is going to make that big of a difference to your home field advantage, then you don't have a home field advantage. You got squat. If you really feel the need to do that, if you're going to hold those tickets back so we can have all of our lazy little fans out here make sure that they get their tickets first, come on. That is a cheap thing to do. You know, my goodness gracious. Now, you know, hey, it's your right to do that. That's fine. But I think it's pretty small, and I think it's pretty pathetic. So, you know, I mean, no team wants to fill their stadium with fans from the other team. But you're not going to fill the stadium with Pats fans. And like I said, this past Sunday, the Patriots had more Jets fans in here than at any other time that I can remember in the 5 years that Gillette Stadium has been here. And I've seen it. I've been here, so I know this. And to be honest with you, it didn't matter one bit. If anything, it served to rile up the Patriots fans that were here. And we actually had, I thought, a pretty decent home crowd. We've banged on our own home crowd here at Gillette all season long this year as being subpar, as being spoiled, as being not into it. And I thought our fans did as good a job as they've done all year long this past Sunday. Oh, by the way, I believe the Patriots won the game by 21 points last I counted. I think it was like 37-16, was it not? So did all of those Jets fans make a difference? No. And if your team is worth the damn, then the opposing team's fans aren't going to make a difference. Unbelievable. By the way, just as an aside, Charger fans, the Patriots have never, let me repeat this, the Patriots have never restricted ticket sales to their games. So there you go. Just a little, you know, just a little cannon fodder, just a little, you know, grist for the mill, so to speak. I thought you'd be interested in that. No, but it comes to us from Ticketmaster and from a story that the Boston Globe had in today's paper. Webradio at Patriots.com. If you'd like to comment on that particular issue, you certainly can do so. One way or the other, matters not to me. Our Bolt fan, Josh, writes, when Samuel got that interception touchdown last week, do you think he was celebrating and pointing? Do you think when he was celebrating and pointing, was he pointing at the owner's box? Maybe his way of saying, pay me. Asante, if you knew anything about the Patriots at all, Josh, Asante points at everything he picks. It's his way of, I guess, pointing to the heaven and saying, thank you for the ability you gave me. That's it in a nutshell. No, I don't think he was pointing to the owner's box. No, I don't think he was telling Bob Kraft, pay me. And as I suggested on yesterday's program, if you were paying attention, Josh, because I know you were here, I know you listened because you sent me three or four emails yesterday, so that's fine. But I don't think the Patriots are going to re-sign him. I don't think the Patriots are going to pay him. If the Chargers want him, fine, go ahead. Pay him an exorbitant salary. Pay him an inflated salary. Go. Give it to him. You know, that's fine. Whatever you think. And then you'll see what you get when you get it. Is he a good cornerback? Yes. Is he a great cornerback? No. That's what I think. Jim in Antarctica. John, I agree with you on the must-wrap-up observation. To offer a different must for the Pats, though, I'd go with the Pats must take care of the ball and come out ahead of the Chargers in the turnover margin. There you go. All right. Certainly, I think that's crucial to any big game. You need to come out. It doesn't make it impossible to win if you turn the ball over more than your opponent in the playoffs, but it certainly makes it much harder, and those mistakes are certainly magnified in games of this magnitude. And so to end up on the plus side of the turnover margin, I think, is going to be key. The Patriots, I believe, were just behind the Chargers in terms of the overall margin. I think the Pats were like fourth in the league, and the Chargers were third in the plus minus. So both teams have an advantage in that regard. And obviously you'd expect, you know, teams with the records that they had, 14-2 for the Chargers, you know, and now 13 wins against four losses for the Patriots, you'd have to expect teams with those kind of records to have a plus in the plus minus. So whichever team ends up in that particular realm on Sunday is going to have, yes, a definitive advantage. I would definitely agree. Thank you with that, Jim. Scott sends an email. He says, what is the point of comparing the Patriots' D-line versus the Chargers' D-line? As far as I know, they are never on the field at the same time. What weaknesses in the Patriots' O-line can the Chargers exploit? I don't know. Were we comparing the Patriots' D-line and the Chargers' D-line? Was that something that Sean was doing?
No, we had an email on the last show.
Oh, okay. Well, since that was the last show, Scott, I can't You know, I don't know the context in which the question was asked, so forgive me, but that gets punted. As far as analysis, what weaknesses in the Patriots' O-line can the Chargers exploit? Well, certainly around the tackles. I think that certainly one of the big matchups of the game will be Matt Leid against Sean Merriman, because we know that with the Chargers playing three-down linemen, like the Patriots do, playing the 34 defense, that Jamal Williams over center, quite often on the outside over the left tackle, that's where Sean Merriman lines up when they put a fourth man down on the line of scrimmage. And so you would expect that matchup to be light versus Merriman, and I think that that is one matchup that they certainly can exploit, because Light's weakness is a rushing defensive end slash outside linebacker that has particularly quick speed, quick feet, and a burst off the line. In other words, you know, has a great start, moves at the drop of a dime, so to speak. You know, he just has that quick first step, and that's usually what leaves him gasping and grasping at air. So I certainly believe that that is a weakness that the Patriots have. Matt Light's a good tackle. He's not a great tackle. That's a weakness, a perceived weakness that Sean Merriman and or the Patriots, the Chargers defensive line can exploit. I think that's the major one. On the other side of the line, where you have Nick Kazier and or Ryan O'Callaghan, who's a rookie, lining up at right tackle, I think Luis Castillo, I believe, is like third on the team in sacks for the Chargers. I think Castillo will have a better than average chance of creating pressure by beating either one of those tackles that are in the game. So there you go, Scott. Right off the bat, I definitely believe that the tackles on the Patriots' offensive line are exploitable. And it will be incumbent to see how the Patriots decide to give those tackles help. My guess is that, like the Jets game this past Sunday, what you'll end up seeing is you'll end up seeing the Patriots keeping a back in the backfield to pick up somebody who gets by their man on that first charge, whether that's Kevin Faulk, whether that's Corey Dillon, whether that's even Lawrence Maroney. But somebody back there will be back there most of the time. I don't think you'll see some empty sets. You'll see a lot of shotgun, however, because that's when Brady's under center. I think what you're doing is you're inviting that kind of a blitz, that kind of a rush, and that's what the Jets took best advantage of back in November when they beat the Patriots here. So I do think you'll see when the Patriots spread it out that Brady's going to go out of the shotgun, and oftentimes there will be somebody back there to help take on the blockers. Scott, thank you for that. Here's one from Glenn, who says, if the Patriots can jump on the Chargers early, like a 10 to a 14-point lead, they can start to dictate play. Shut down the run, force Rivers to beat them is their best bet, and the only way I see them doing that is a quick start. The Chargers are a good team, but are they battle-tested? The Patriots have players that have played in big games, and the game won't be too big for them. In the fourth quarter, will the untested Chargers be able to respond? We shall see. It should be a great game. Also, love how Brady at his news conference started and stated that the Chargers coaches and players don't think too highly of them. And he gets that through Riche. Apparently something that Riche Caldwell told them. Always love when the Patriots players feel they are being slighted by another team. Kind of reminds me of Pittsburgh. That's a good analogy. Thank you, Glenn. Appreciate that. And we'll let you hear Brady's analogy from what he got from Riche Caldwell coming up in just a couple of moments. Webradio@patriots.com. Again, that's the email address. Webradio@patriots.com. 508-543-7482 is the telephone number. Let's take you to Bill Belichick now. Give you a chance to hear the questions being asked of him and his complete response. As the Patriots have handed out the playbook, they have handed out the game plan, and they're just now wrapping up their first practice and preparing for the San Diego Chargers.
Okay. Well, I think just speaking for our football team, coaching staff, I think we all know kind of a challenge we have in front of us this week with the Chargers. No question, they're the best team in the league. They've had an outstanding year, you know, 14-2, and their only two losses are, you know, right at the end of the game, very close games. So just about everything you want to say about that football team, complimentary, is well-deserved. You know, they do everything very well. I think, you know, it starts right at the top with, you know, A.J. and Marty. They put together an outstanding team. You know, it's a very young team. I know they have a couple experienced players on either side of the ball, you know, Godfrey and Edwards on defense and Keenan and and Lorenzo there on offense, but, you know, it's a very young, talented group. They've drafted extremely well. You know, they've got great players at every position. Their team really is the all-pro team. You know, they got a ton of players. I have total a lot of respect for Marty, what he's done. He's had a tremendous career. You know, his 200 win and 15 winning seasons, and, you know, he's pretty much there every single year. And, you know, his teams always play well. I think the biggest thing about San Diego that impresses me is just how few mistakes they make. You know, they don't turn the ball over. They don't have many bad plays against them. They're consistent. They're tough. And they make you earn everything they get, everything you get. And, you know, it's hard to get anything on them. You know, it's hard to stop them. It's hard to move the ball on them. Their front seven's outstanding. They're very good on special teams. And scoring, you know, we always talk every week about playing four quarters of football, but, you know, you look at the 176 points they scored in the fourth quarter. I mean, that's so far off the charts, it's hard to even relate it to anything else. They just, you know, and think about it, they won 14 games, so it's not like they're coming from behind every week. You know, they put up points from beginning of the game to the end of the game and do it a lot of different ways. They have a lot of great weapons. Outstanding football team, and, you know, it's a huge challenge for us going out there where they're undefeated at home. We're going to have to play our best football game. And so that's what we're going to prepare to do this week. But it's a big challenge out of us. We know we're in for, you know, it's going to be a tough fight out there.
Bill, how do Phillips and Merriman kind of affect how quarterbacks play? How does a quarterback have to be aware of what they do?
Well, I think it's more of a problem for the guys who are blocking them. Yeah. You know, I mean, a quarterback can't block them. You know, it's... Those are guys that, you know, most of the time you would have picked up. It's like a defensive lineman. You know, somebody's assigned to him. But, you know, having somebody assigned to him and getting them blocked is two different things. But they have a good defensive system. You know, Wade's been at it a long time. His teams have always played well defensively wherever he's been. And, you know, their linebackers are an outstanding group. They have a great front seven. And those two guys off the edge are tough. But they, you know, they bring the inside people as well, Godfrey and Edwards in different combinations. So it's, you know, they bring, you know, sometimes one, sometimes the outside two, the inside two off one side, two off the other side. So they keep you off balance. You got to block all seven of them, and they're hard to get blocked.
Do they play Merriman and Phillips down much?
In sub?
Yeah. Yeah,
not in regular. They play 3-4, and they're outside linebackers.
Like you guys do. And
yep.
Both of them on the
outside. Yeah, that's the way it is for most 3-4 teams. Okay. I'd say the majority of them, anytime they go to a 4-3, or a four-man line sub-defense, that their outside linebackers really are their defensive ends in pass rush. Pittsburgh, Dallas, you know, just about everybody does that. Cleveland.
Do they mix it up much? Do they, like, really take Phillips and drop him and rush Merriman or, you know, drop both
yeah.
sometimes? It's just hard to get a read on what they're doing, what you're saying, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah, they bring them all. They bring the two outside guys, the two inside guys, two to the left, two to the right, two strong, two weak, bring one. You know, so they give you a lot of different combinations, and you have to be ready to block all four of them, or, you know, all seven of them, really. You don't know which five it's going to be or four it's going to be.
Phil, part of obviously Tomlinson is, you know, has a lot of speed, a lot of athletic ability, but is part of what makes him so dangerous is knowledge on how to use that speed and athletic ability.
Yeah, well, he definitely knows how to use it, and they get in the ball in a lot of different ways. You know, he's a second leading receiver. And, you know, he gets the ball out of the backfield. He gets it on, you know, a variety of running plays. They run him on sweeps, off-tackle plays, inside plays, misdirection plays, draws, and use him in the passing game on some routes, some checkdowns, screens. So, you know, he's a guy that they get the ball to in a lot of different ways, and he's outstanding. He can do it all. He can run inside, run outside. Obviously, he's tremendously talented in the open field and has a great nose for the goal line. Nobody finds the end zone better than he does. So he's outstanding with the ball in his hands. And, you know, when they hand it to him, there's no way to keep him from getting it. You know, in a passing game, you know, maybe you could do something to try to take him away as a pass receiver. But, you know, when they hand the ball in the running game, you know, you've got to tackle him.
So what did you see in Caldwell that made him appealing as a free agent?
Well, you know, we knew Rashea coming out and, of course, you know, he had a good game against us here last year. But, you know, I think he's a talented receiver that when he had an opportunity to play and, you know, he had some injury history out there where he wasn't able to, you know, perform all the time. But, you know, when he was able to play, he was a player that could get open and had good hands, could catch the ball, create some separation.
When you look at that receiver group as a whole, from where it started this season to where it is now, what stands out to you, the way that group has evolved?
They work hard. They work hard, they're well prepared, and they really try to do all the little things to get it right. So I have a lot of respect for them.
Have you seen just steady improvement, or did you notice a point where, you
know? No, I think it's been steady. I think they come in and get film and start looking at the game on Monday, the game that we just played, and correct those mistakes, and then Tuesday start looking at the next opponent, and, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, red area, third down, 2 minute, all those situational things. They work hard. They study a lot of film. They go over their assignments. They help each other out. They watch film together as a group, try to, you know, watch with the quarterbacks. So, you know, I'm impressed with the way they work. I think it's been consistent. It continues to get better. How much does? Oh, of course. He's the guy who's throwing the ball. So, tell you what, they listen a lot more to what he says than what I say. You know, if I tell him to run a route at 14, that's good. He tells them to run it at 14, they're going to run it at 14 because these guys throw on the ball. I don't throw on the ball. So I think it's always good to have your quarterback and receivers working together. Tom's outstanding at working with all of his teammates, running backs, the tight ends, the receivers, all of them. And, you know, it's critical that the receivers and the quarterback are on the same page in terms of the decision-making and what each guy sees. And so they all see the same thing so they can execute the play. He's great at it. Yeah, he sure has. You know, and again, I talk about the receivers coming in here, but he's a guy that's meeting with them, working with them, and, you know, showing them extra film and taking extra time. You know, each guy, like any position, each guy has his own strengths and weaknesses, things that he does well or has his own individual techniques or maneuvers or whatever. And Brian's done a great job of, you know, incorporating those into the overall system and, you know, refining some things that need a little more work and, you know, including the running game. So, I mean, he's done a great job.
How do you prepare a quarterback who's making his first career playoff start, like Rivers?
I think that's a question you need to ask Marty. But, you know, he's 14-2, so, I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about that. He's done pretty well.
Can you relate it with Brady back in 01?
Well, not really. It's two different teams. I'm sure you do the same thing you do every week. Study the opponent, go through the game plan. Make sure that the, you know, your players are aware of what they need to do and how you want them to execute those plays.
So your red zone defense obviously has done quite well. Could you talk about the emotional value when you can either hold the opponent to a field goal or nothing?
Well, of course, it depends on the situation. You know, anytime the offense gets the ball down there, you know, like what happened last week, you know, when they recover a fumble down there, well, they're already in field goal range. So, you know, defensively, you know, to be able to hold them to a field goal there is like a three and out. It's, you know, almost as good as you can do other than turn the ball over. You know, when they drive it the whole length of the field and you hold them to a field goal, I mean, it's better to let them in the end zone. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to feel good about, you know, when they're just taking the ball 65 yards on you. So, it could go a little bit both ways. But certainly the defensive objective is to keep them out of the end zone. And, you know, if you can limit the amount of points, then that obviously increases your chances of winning, puts a lot less pressure on the offense, and gives you confidence that you can stop them sometimes, even though it's been after they've gained some yardage. At least, you know, when you walk back out there on the field next time, you do feel like, well, at least we did get them stopped. You know, we just got to get it done earlier.
Given their ability to control the pace of the game with a back like Tomlinson later in the game.
Wait a minute, just not to cut you off here, but, I mean, I wouldn't stop at Tomlinson now. I mean, they got to – you know, they got several good backs, and Turner's averaging almost a yard to carry more than he is. And, you know, Neal's a pain in the neck. So, and that's not taking anything away from Tomlinson. Believe me, I'm not saying that. But it's, you know, it's not like when he's not in there, well, they have no running game. I mean, they got a real good one too.
With that ground game, then, how important is it for you guys to avoid digging yourself a hole early, getting up on them, kind of avoid a double digit deficit?
I mean, believe it or not, that's what we usually try to do. I mean, I've never stood up in front of the team and said, you know, fellas, you know, if we're down by 14, don't worry about it. You know, we still got a good game plan at that point. You know, and there's times when you got to play in that situation. But, you know, you always want to try to play from ahead. You always want to try to go out there and establish, you know, your game plan, your tempo at the beginning of the game and get the game in under control and play from, you know, even or ahead. So, you know, you always try to do that. But there's no question that San Diego is a great team. When they are ahead, they have an outstanding running game, play-action passing game. They can rush the passer, 60-some sacks or whatever it is. So, you know, when you're behind on them, then as we know from last year, it just really just gets worse. You know, they tee off on the quarterback. It's harder to throw. And, you know, they can run the ball with it as well as any team in the league. And so it's hard to get it away from them, and they can chew up the clock and, you know, just play keep away. So they're, you know, you don't want to be in that situation. You know, there's no question you don't want to be in that situation. But, you know, we never want to be in that situation. So
is it down and distance that determines how much you pay attention to Tomlinson versus Gates? Because
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, down and distance is a factor, but I wouldn't say it's the only factor. He, you know, Tomlinson gets the ball, and like I said, he's a second leading receiver. So, you know, he gets the ball in other down and distance situations besides first down, as does Gates get it on a lot of other situations besides third down. So, you know, I think you defend players based on down and distance is a part of it, field position could be a part of it, and certainly formation. You know, you need to know where they are and what they kind of do from those certain sets. You know, a lot of times you can, when you look at a formation, you can eliminate certain plays that they want to run or certain routes that a receiver will run just by either his location or where the other people are around him. So, you know, you try to eliminate some things. But, you know, again, they have a multiple offense. They shift and move people around a lot. And they do a good job of game planning. So it's, you know, it's hard to know exactly, you know, where they're going to be. I mean, even Tomlinson, you know, he's out of the backfield a decent amount and in empty formations and stuff like that. I mean, that's a problem. And then they, you know, they run him out of the backfield on pass routes. So, you know, you can stack your defense in there for the running game, but sometimes you got to cover him, you know, on perimeter passing plays as well. So it's, you know, I think it's a combination of things.
Is there any chance that you would put Samuel on Gates?
It's a chance.
Speaking of chances, what are the chances that Rodgers could suit up in this game?
Well, I have the injury report at the practice, Mike. I know you'll be waiting anxiously for it. So,
I think you said on Monday there comes a point where you can just get too much film on an opponent and just have too much information. When you're looking at film of an opponent, what's more important, the games that they lost or the games they played the defense that's over the years?
Well, I think you can learn something from every game. I think that at this point when you've watched San Diego play 1,000 plays on offense, 1,000 plays on defense, plus, you know, we played them last year and all that, you know, it's some way you just got to boil it down. You know, you can't, it's just too much to, I mean, they can't run all that against us or anybody for that matter. There's just not enough time, not enough plays. So you have to boil it down to what, you know, where you're going to put your, where you're going to put your emphasis and go with that. And then, you know, be aware of some other things maybe that they've done or could do. But I think there's a lot of things to take into consideration, teams that have done well against them, teams that haven't done well. Maybe that's, you know, how not to do it sometimes is as important as how to do it. You know, close games, teams that play a similar defense or similar front or similar coverages, you know, I think that there can be some application there. But, you know, in the end, I think you've just kind of, it's got to be a culmination of, you know, a lot of different informational points and then put it all together. I think it's just hard to say, well, we're just going to look at this one game or we're just going to look at this one thing that somebody or other did. It's a little broader than that. I don't think you can boil it down quite that far.
When you boil it all down, have you ever seen a team, say, as balanced or well-balanced on both sides of the ball as this year's addition to Chargers?
Well, I've seen some pretty good football teams now. I mean, but I would certainly put them up there, you know, 14-2 and like I said, just losing, you know, two real close games. They can run it, they can throw it, play good defense. I mean, you know, that's why they're 14-2. That's why they're the best team in the league. They do everything well. They're well coached, they're tough, physical, they don't make a lot of mistakes, and they do a lot of things well, and they got a lot of good players. So
Bill, what impresses you about Rivers?
Well, I mean, number one is record. You know, I think that's the bottom line. They don't have many turnovers. You know, he doesn't give the ball away much, makes good decisions, got a good arm, he's athletic. He's got some quickness in the pocket, he's got a strong arm, can throw off balance, and that, you know, he doesn't have any problem getting the ball there. Won't be a question of arm strength or accuracy. So he's, you know, like a lot of their young players. And you know, I think San Diego has as many as anybody I've seen in a long time. You know, they have a lot of not only young players, but a lot of quality young players, a lot of good ones, you know, on both sides of the ball and in the kicking game. So, you know, he's one of many that I would throw into that category.
Does it appear to you that they've expanded his responsibilities in the passing game over the second half of the season?
Looks like they pretty much, you know, run their passing game. I didn't think that they, you know, didn't have an extensive passing game earlier in the year. So, I don't know. I mean, I would say watching them play offensively, I don't think there's a lot of things that they don't feel like he can do, or a lot of differences really from last year when Drew ran it. It looks like they run the plays that, you know, that are inherent to that offense, and that complement the running game, and that complement each other in the passing game. They run them. He executes them, and, you know, they hit plenty of them.
There's been a common theme, though, sort of all year, people watching them saying that maybe Cam Cameron's had more of an influence on their offense, and maybe Marty's loosened it up a little bit and let Cam do a little bit more with that offense. You see that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they could do much more than what they did with it against us last year, whoever's doing it. And they ran us off the field. You know, that score is 24-0 in the second half. Scored 41 points. I mean, I don't know. Didn't look too bad to me last year. Averaging 31 points a game this year. I mean, I don't know what more they got to do. I mean, hope they don't do too much more than what they did. You know, 41 points. Hope it's not too much more than that this time.
So what do you think of the defensive attributes of Matt White?
Well, I think there are a lot of things you got to have to play that position. You know, athletic ability and size, quickness is one of them. You know, mental toughness, intelligence, technique. So I think all those things are important. You know, you take a good athlete that doesn't play with good technique, and they probably won't get very far. Take a guy that's got good technique and isn't very good athlete, probably won't get very far. You know, guys that make mistakes out there, you know, there's not a lot of times you can get help. You know, centers and guards are tied up inside, so it's, you know, one-on-one. Miss an assignment, or, you know, have a bad set, or, you know, make a mistake, then, you know, there's not much of a second line of defense. Whereas a lot of times with the guards and centers, there's kind of 3-on-2 in there, especially in the passing game, and or, you know, you've got the linebacker off the line of scrimmage. It's not, you know, doesn't happen quite as quick. It's not usually not quite as big of a disaster if it happens inside compared to outside. So, but I think all those things are important. You know, without any of them, you know, you could, the weaknesses could offset the strengths in a hurry. Well, I mean, the safety is in the corners. You know, I mean, that's kind of more at the end of the play. Tackles, it's kind of more at the beginning of the play. Yeah, well, sure. I mean, yeah, on defense, the secondary is the last line of defense. So however, the coverage and the play unfolds, yeah, usually when it gets to them, you know, your defensive ends and your nose tackles aren't going to run too many guys down. So, you know, if they don't make the play, that's pretty much the last line of defense. A lot of cases, that's true of the tackles, too. You know, those linemen are all committed on somebody else. And, you know, we talked about, well, you can keep somebody in. I mean, that, a lot of times keeping somebody in just brings somebody else into the picture. So, you know, that's not really the answer either. I mean, what you really need from your tackles is for them to be able to block the guys they got to block.
So, is it a pretty common characteristic to a Wade Phillips?
Well, they're all pretty good. You know, he's 3-4 base guy, and you know, he's always had good linebackers. Always seems like he's always had a good nose tackle, and I would certainly put Williams in that category. But they're tough to run against. You know, they're tough to throw against, just in terms of blocking the front. You know, he's not a real exotic guy. You know, with 50 new defenses every week, that's not really his thing. They do what they do. They do it well, and you got to block them. You know, you got to block them, and you got to get open on them. You know, that's, I don't think finding them is going to be the problem. You know, where's McCree going to line up? Where's Edwards going to line up? You know, where's Williams going to? You know, I don't think that'll be a problem. I think blocking them is going to be a problem. I think getting open is going to be a problem. But I think that's, you know, that, you know, he's a very good fundamental coach. His teams always play with good technique. They're tough. They hustle to the ball. And they don't give up a lot of big plays because they're sound and they kind of, you know, they know what they're doing. They execute it well.
Is there any difference with Pittsburgh
3-4? Oh, yeah. I think it's, yeah. Well, I mean, there's certainly some carryover, but I would say that there's a significant amount of differences too, yeah. But there, you know, I mean, there's some elements of 3-4 linebackers pressuring, but I'd say less zone blitzing. Although San Diego does, they certainly do their share of zone blitzing now.
Bill, Rivers is still relatively inexperienced at this stage of his career. Does it give you an opportunity maybe to try to get in his head a little bit, show him some things that maybe he hasn't quite seen?
Look, all we're trying to do is stop their whole offense. You can't stop one guy. You just can't stop one guy. And they got too many good players. They got a good offensive line, good tight ends, good backs, good receivers. So, you know, you can't. I think everybody's got to do their job. You got to play good team defense. I don't think you can just, you know, gang up on one guy. They got too many of them.
Phil, when you're scouting the guy who hasn't played college football like Neil or Gates, what are some of the things that you're going to look for right away and say, okay, he needs to have this, this, and this?
Well, I think the number one thing you've got to see in that situation is you know, athletic ability, and then, you know, a couple characteristics like, you know, a guy that'll work hard and has some intelligence and you know, has some toughness. But, you know, you're obviously not going to see a refined player, so that's, you know, techniques and understanding and instincts and all that. You know, you're probably starting from scratch at that point. You just got to hope that you'll be able to improve those things in time with, you know, with reps and experience and understanding. But so therefore a player's chance to make up for it would be, you know, athletic ability and some physical characteristics. But, you know, anybody that's that far behind would have to be you know, pretty intelligent, pretty hard working in order to make up, you know, the amount of ground that they would have to make up with other players who, you know, have been playing the game a lot longer.
Does it take a great deal of patience on a coach's part?
Well, it depends on how fast the player comes along. I mean, players come along fast. I don't think it takes too much patience at all. You know, if it's a long, it's looks like it's gonna be a long process, then you just got to decide how long you're willing to wait and what kind of upside, you know, what are you developing? I guess that's the question you got to ask yourself. I mean, you developing a guy who's gonna, you know, maybe make your roster, maybe not, probably never really be able to have a chance to you know, have a lot of playing time, be a legitimate player for you. You know, I mean, you want to put three years into that project. I mean, you could probably find other guys that could come in and do that a lot quicker without all that work. Now, you know, I think the guy's got a lot more upside, and he could be a, you know, a, kind of a full-time player for you, or, you know, a real solid contributor, you know, more than just the guy that, you know, might be able to hang on and roster for a year or two. Then, you know, you're developing a different type of player. So I think that's, you know, something you got to take into consideration. Just, you know, what kind of upside you think the player has in your system.
What did you see in Neil early on that made you think he'd be worth keeping around?
Well, obviously not enough because we, you know, we let him go, but then we brought him back. I mean, you know, first we started him off on defense, which that was stupid. I mean, he can't play defense, but he can run and he's big and he's physical, but the game was just too fast for him on the defensive side of the ball. There's just too many things happen, and he couldn't. He just couldn't play on the defensive side of the ball. So by the time we moved him over to offense, that first year he was so far behind in terms of terminology, and, you know, I mean, he didn't know where the huddle was, where to line up in the huddle. So by the time the end of training camp came, we knew he couldn't play defense, and then he was so far behind offensively that it was just, there was a lot of ground to make up. But, you know, by the end of the year, we had some injuries, some, you know, roster maneuvering took place. We were able to carry him, you know, as a rostered player, even though he never played, you know, at the end of that season. And because we did like his work ethic, we did like his toughness and his athletic ability, and, you know, kind of wanted to put in another year with him, but starting from scratch on the offensive side of the ball, not, you know, not juggling him around like we did. And that actually worked out, you know, pretty well. And of course, he got hurt in the 2002 season, and so, you know, had a little temporary setback there. But again, I think that's a real credit to him, even though he missed that time in the, you know, most of the second half of the 2002 season, or second two thirds of it, whatever it was, you know, that he was able to come back and, you know, continue to develop as a player, even though he, you know, was out, had some missed playing time.
Coach, can you talk about the threat that Jackson poses? similar in any way to the big receivers you faced in Jacksonville recently?
Yeah, sure is. I think he's probably a little maybe a little quicker, you know, than a couple of those guys. But yeah, he's a big target. He's like a I mean, not quite a tight end, but he's, you know, somewhere in there between. I mean, he's a big receiver. You know, he's a guy that's big. He's a great target. You know, tough guy to bring down after the catch. So, you know, he's worked his way into the lineup, and you know, McCardle's really now become more of the third receiver. And you know, Jackson's a, you know, he's an imposing guy out there, and you know, he's definitely a, you know, a problem to tackle. He's a problem to cover. You know, his size presents a problem down the field. And he's also, you know, a good target on, you know, the shorter intermediate plays where you lay off him and he catches it and then breaks a tackle and, you know, gains yards as a runner. So, right after the catch. So, it's definitely a problem. You know, Parker and McCardle, I mean, they have a good group of receivers to go with their tight ends and backs.
Can you talk about your history with
McCardle? Well, Keenan was like an 18th round draft choice or something like that by the Redskins. I forget, it was pretty... more rounds than we have now, and so he was a Plan B signing in Cleveland. Different but similar to the Troy Brown scenario, you know, on and off the roster, practice squad. Didn't play, but you know, in the opportunities he did get to play, he played pretty well. And by the end there, by 94 and then even 95, you know, he worked and developed into, you know, one of our best receivers. And quick, smart, real good hands. Has a great sense of instinctiveness for the game, getting open, knowing how to set people up. You know, he's not the fastest guy, he's not the strongest guy, but he's quick, he's got great hands, he's got great instincts, and the quarterbacks have a lot of confidence in him, as they should. And then he went down to Jacksonville, and, you know, he's had a tremendous career. So, you know, it's the kind of guy you know, I think you always hold up as a model for, you know, other young players that, you know, here's a guy that was... you know, barely drafted, you know, out of UNLV, or, you know, Troy Brown, Marshall, you know, late pick that, you know, anybody could have had him, was with a couple other teams, was set on the practice squad, bounced around a little bit, but just kept working, kept getting better, and both those guys have gone on to have, you know, great careers. You know.
Bill, I guess it's coming out of San Diego this morning that the Chargers are blocking most of their tickets for the Charger fans. Do you have any comment on that?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to coach a team. I don't really care about tickets. I think you need to talk to somebody else about the ticket situation. Any football questions? Or?
Lorenzo Neal,
running.
That, of course, is Patriot head coach Bill Belichick, and that's from earlier today here at Gillette Stadium as we're in hour number two of Patriots Playbook here on Patriots.com radio. And got some exciting news to tell you about for those of you who are Patriots fans and followers, as that the Pro Football Hall of Fame has just announced its class of finalists, which will ultimately be voted on by the Board of Selectors at the Super Bowl and then announced thereafter. A member of the Board of Selectors, so there's one for each of the 32 teams in the league. There's two in New York, obviously, because there's two teams. And the New England representative, the Boston representative on the Board of Selectors, is Ron Borges of the Boston Globe. And Ron Borges joins us here on Patriots Playbook. Ron, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for a minute.
Well, it's a great reason to be talking. I'm very excited for Tippett.
Yeah, the announcement is, of course, that Andre Tippett, former Patriot linebacker, is now a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He is among the 17 that will be ultimately considered by you and the others on the Board of Selection when you meet in Miami the day before the Super Bowl, actually on Saturday, February 3rd. Can you kind of take us through the process, just a little bit of what that's all about?
Well, you get there about 7 in the morning and around some sort of board business that usually gets taken care of in the first half hour or so, and then about 7:30, 7:45, you start to present each candidate, and generally you will present a candidate from your city. So in my case, Tipper will be my responsibility to present his credentials and whatever any other information I have to make the best case for him. Generally, you try to talk to a lot of opposing players, opposing coaches, Hall of Famers, who would have, you know, positive viewpoints on your guy, and then you, once you're done, then you sit down and there's a debate for some more heated than others. You know, if you got John Elway, mm-hmm. greatest presentation ever, the guy stood up and said, I present John Elway. He sat down. It was great. You know, well, what's that to say? You know, can we move on to the next guy?
That's great.
Sometimes it gets pretty heated, and you'll get some questions about some specific things. You know, why didn't he do this, or why did he do that, or maybe you have a guy who didn't play as many years as you might normally expect, or whatever the case might be. Some guys have sort of odd statistical things. Kenny Stabler has been stopped several times, I think, because he's a 50% career passer. Well, he's a 50% career passer because back in those days, they were throwing 40-yard passes, not 4-yard sideways.
Right.
So, you know, you're not going to be as accurate. But, you know, a lot of those kind of things. So then we go through each one of the 17 guys, which includes two selections from the Veterans Committee.
Right.
And then there's a vote to cut it down, the list down to 10. Then these guys dressed up like accountants. They come in, take about an hour to count the 38 ballots. It's unbelievable. no wonder accountants make so much money. You know? Then they come back, and now we have the list of 10, and we debate those guys a second time. And if the guy that you originally presented is still there, you make basically a second pitch for him. A lot of times the debate is a little moves a little quicker the second time around, although sometimes it can get pretty heated over a particular guy. And then we vote again, and we cut the one. So usually by about 1 o'clock or so, you know, we've got it down to the final
mm-hmm.
4, 6, whatever it is, who ultimately get in. And then they don't tell us how that final ballot goes. We find out at 2 o'clock, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when they have the press conference, same as everybody else.
So it's a whittling down process. It's not, I guess, dissimilar to how they go about voting for Olympic Games sites. You go through a process, you eliminate somebody, and then you come back and you basically vote all over again once you whittle it down to that final 10, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. And be honest with you, I've done it, I don't know, forget, 5 or 6 years now, and it's a lot more difficult. I was a lot more critical of people when I was not on the committee than I am now. It's a lot more difficult than people think. Even the list of 15, I haven't seen this year's list yet, but I'm sure you can make a case for just about everybody. And certainly when you cut it to 10, you're not really voting somebody. Well, in reality, you're sort of forced to vote somebody down, but that's not really what you're doing.
Right.
You know, you're voting for the 4 guys, 6 guys, whatever it is you put on your list. It's very tough.
Yeah, each class is to be between 3 and 6 players. It's only been as few as 3 players, though, twice, I believe, in the history of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So you can go up to 6. Here's the list of players. So let me get at least your initial response to it. The 17 that are on the list to be considered for Hall induction are on the senior committee, Cleveland Brown guard Gene Hickerson and Detroit tight end Charlie Sanders. The modern era players include defensive ends Fred Dean and Richard Dent. Guards Russ Grimm and Bob Kuchenberg, punter Ray Guy, receivers Art Monk and Andre Reed, at linebacker, obviously, we've talked about Andre Tippett and Derek Thomas, cornerback Roger Worley, and tackle Gary Zimmerman. There's your list.
I would say you could open the door to just about all those people.
Sure.
Who could complain? You know, Tippett's up against in a tough situation because you basically have 6 pass rushers there.
Right.
And all 6, obviously, are not going to get in. And you've got a lot of guys with great credentials. I mean, Derek Thomas has great credentials. Fred Dean, when I was covering the Raiders, and he was a great player with San Diego. Then ultimately he ended up with the 49ers when I was around those guys. So
mm-hmm.
I know him very well. You know, Richard Dent, we all know the player he was in Chicago. So,
sure.
It's pretty tough. Bob Kuchenberg's been up many times.
Art Monk has been up many times.
Now, I've sort of said this publicly, so this is nothing new. I mean, I've always voted no on Art Monk, even though when he retired, he had the most catches in the history of the game at that time. And I've been skewered more than a few times in emails and, you know, from angry Art Monk fans.
Right.
But I'm also on the Boxing Hall of Fame, and I think the Boxing Hall of Fame has made a big mistake in being too... The doors are too wide open.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's not the Hall of Very Good. You know, it's the Hall of Great.
Okay.
And when I talk to and have talked to in the past opposing coaches from that era, defensive coaches, to a man, they tell me Art Monk was not the guy they game planned against. Art Monk was not the guy they worried about. They worried about Gary Clark. They worried about Ricky Sanders. They worried about John Riggins, but they didn't worry about Art Monk. And they weren't worrying about him then, you know.
Uh-huh.
Exactly why is he in the Hall of Fame? Because he caught a lot of short passes.
Right.
But there's some very adamant supporters of him, and I'm sure he'll
Is this, does this, Ron, turn into a political battle where if you say give a vote to Art Monk, you might get somebody else to turn the corner on Andre Tippett?
I'm sure there's some of that that goes on. I've been fortunate enough, I think guys know me well enough, whether you like me or dislike me, that that wouldn't work too well with me. So I haven't really been in that situation. But certainly you talk to guys and you make your case, you know, privately as well as publicly.
Right.
For
right.
Player. And I'm willing to listen every year. I mean, I voted for Harry Carson for the first time last year after having voted no, I don't know, four times probably.
Right.
And the reason I finally voted for him last year was two things, actually. Parcells called me and made a very sort of adamant pitch that swayed me a little bit. And then the other conclusion I finally came to was he had been a finalist, I think, I'm probably going to get the number wrong, but 7-8 times, something like that,
mm-hmm.
and never gotten in. And I finally said to myself, you know, okay, I think he was a really good player. I personally don't think he was a Hall of Fame player. But if this many guys in this group, who I respect, think he is, and continue to get him to this point, who am I to keep saying no?
Right.
So I voted for him.
Sure.
And in Tip's case, this is the first time he's ever going to be debated in the room, which is... And I will admit to having politicked on that point over the last 2-3 years at every meeting we would have, because we meet several times during the year, and using Tippett as the poster boy for a lot of other guys who played on basically lousy teams most of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys get short shrift, and the thing I argued was, don't tell me he doesn't deserve to be debated. Now, you can argue of whether or not he actually should be in the Hall of Fame from whatever point of view you want to take, but don't tell me he didn't play good enough to at least be discussed. And ultimately, I think that argument carries some weight.
Well, I've just got this down from the Hall of Fame, so that's why I'm kind of reading it as we go along here. But the four obvious, the biggest names on this list, the other four guys that I did not mention earlier, Paul Tagliabue, Thurman Thomas, Michael Irvin, and Bruce Matthews. Now, do you feel like each one of those four is pretty much a shoe-in?
Well, I would not vote for Tagliabue, and I've said that, I've been asked about that before. I just don't think that every commissioner belongs in the Hall of Fame, and I don't think in this particular case, I feel he was a very effective clerk.
Was the commissioner at the time in which the NFL probably enjoyed his greatest in terms of popularity, right?
Well, he did, but he also was commissioner during a time where teams were abandoning cities that didn't deserve to be abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
He was a commissioner during a time of a terrible strike. He was a commissioner who had to be talked out of rebating money to the networks.
Sure.
And he almost did it. And he was a commissioner at the end whose final act was to ramrod through a labor agreement that is going to explode in the faces of the owners within a couple of years, and they all know it. So not my choice.
Be interesting to hear that debate, I would think. Very interesting to hear that debate.
Yeah, that'll be hot because he has some strong supporters.
Sure.
The other guys of the last group that you mentioned will be interesting. Bruce Matthews, to me, and this is an example you were asking earlier about how things work.
Right.
He's a great player, in my opinion. Don't get me wrong. But he's up in he's in a difficult situation because the representative for what was then the Houston area with the original Oilers got Mike Munchak in the Hall of Fame a few
mm-hmm.
years back.
Mm-hmm.
Was the other guard on the other side of Matthews for most of those years. Munchak was a good player, but I wasn't on the committee at the time, but to me, no more belongs to the Hall of Fame than I do. Well, if Mike Munchak is in the Hall of Fame, one of their guards, if Bruce Matthews gets in the Hall of Fame as their other guard, and Warren Moon is in there as a quarterback,
yep.
How come they ever won a playoff game? These guys, you know, will be Hall of Fame players.
Hey, well, I would certainly second that one, but, hey, far be it from me to decide what's what, you know?
Yeah, it's tough, though, you know, and it's kind of unfair to Matthews, but it's really causing me a lot of, because I assumed he'd get this far, and it's causing me a lot of difficulties thinking about it.
Well, Ron, and again, I appreciate you taking the time, because obviously this is a story that's just broken out, but what do you think it will take to get Andre Tippett in the Hall of Fame? As you suggested, this is the first time he's actually going to be discussed in the room amongst the Board of Selectors. What do you think could swing it in his favor? Is there anything?
Yeah, well, I don't want to put too much of the weight on on the presenter, but I think he's going to take a pretty good speech. you know, because to many of the guys in that room that I've talked to, and I talked to all but three of the voters during the process leading up to this, because we have two preliminary votes, the cut down from the big list, which is over 100, to 25, and then there's a second vote by email from 25 to 15 before we get in the room. So I had talked to a lot of guys at that point, and many of them had never seen him play. They were never on television. Or they were very seldom on television. They very seldom played Monday Night Football. And he, you know, they briefly had a couple years there in the playoffs. But, of course, the only thing anybody remembers about that is the Bears destroying him. So, you know, he's up against it on that. And it's the problem that any guy who plays most of his career on a team with bad ownership and bad management and bad coaching gets penalized, especially back then because you couldn't escape. There was no free agency back then. Mm-hmm. Today he's been gone in a hurry, you know. So it's going to take some talking, I think. But guys are open-minded, and I think certainly his statistics speak for themselves. I think I'm going to have to try to find something else beyond his stats. And there are some things. You know, he played every down, unlike Derek Thomas. He played on the strong side all the time, unlike any of these other pass rushers. He played on the tight end side.
Mm-hmm.
He made plays down the field in coverage. He forced a reasonable amount of fumbles for his position. You know, so there's a lot of things. And he was a member of the All-Decade team, which always strikes me as odd. How can a guy be considered one of the six best players at his position over a 10-year period and then not get in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, isn't that usually a barometer for fame consideration, being a dominant player, you know, in terms of a series of, you know, say 10 years or a decade?
Sure, you would certainly think so. You take, but Harry Carson's case, for example, I believe, he was on two All-Decade teams because he played in that swing era in the 70s and 80s, and yet it took him 9 tries to get into the Hall of Fame. So
mm-hmm.
There's some oddities there where you kind of go. And the other thing that has hurt Tippett is he had not been on the list at all for quite a few years because you're on the first year that you're eligible, and then if you don't get a certain number of votes, you're off the list. Now the team can petition to put you back on. Your rep from your city can petition. Damn near any fan can call up the Hall of Fame and ask for some guy to be put on there, and they'll usually do it. But for whatever reason, and I think there was an assortment of them, he wasn't on the list. No one asked to put him on the list, so for a long period of time, he wasn't. In the first year I came on, I noticed that, you know, he wasn't on the list. And so I called Hall of Fame and said, I know he's not in the Hall of Fame, so how is this possible?
Mm-hmm.
And they explained to me, you know, what needed to be done, so we got him on the list. And then one of the unfortunate things that happens for a guy like Tippett, who's been retired now, I think, 13 years, I think.
That sounds about right.
Right. You know, when you've been out a long time, John, there'll be a lot of folks that say, well, you know, what's he done in the last 13 years?
Yeah.
You know, why, where's he been?
He's and been then, right here working for the team, yeah.
Exactly, but you're sort of starting from a negative. You know, you're fighting from a negative just to get him to zero.
Mm-hmm.
If he was so good, why wasn't he in before? Well, maybe these other guys made a mistake. Maybe he got overlooked. You know, it's an assortment of at the time that he retired, the team was kind of a laughingstock. So, you know, it was pretty easy for him to be forgotten.
Right.
And his play to be forgotten. So you got to overcome some of that, but it'll be an interesting debate. And I think it's a great honor for him to get this far.
It certainly is that. There's no doubt about that, which is certainly striking. I'm watching the announcement on NFL Network today, and I'm kind of like, wow, this is great. This is a good thing. So thank you for spending a couple of minutes with us to explain the process a little bit. And obviously, there will be a lot of Patriots fans pulling for you, Ron, and your speech that day on Saturday, February 3rd
yeah,
in Miami.
You know, I will say this, and not to overemphasize, but I've had friends of mine from other cities make presentations for players, and I've seen how, frankly, despondent they get when they don't get their guy in. I mean, you really, most of the guys I've seen take it very seriously, and they really try to do their best. And you feel bad if a guy doesn't get in. I know a guy who presented Rayfield Wright a couple years when he did not get in.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't believe it, and I couldn't believe it. Rayfield Wright changed the way you play tackle. You know, to me, how do you not get in?
Mm-hmm.
When the debate came, there was no debate. Nobody asked a question about him, so we figured he's in.
Mm-hmm.
The vote came in down to 10, and he was out. How's that possible? You know?
Unbelievable.
So, but the next year he did manage to get in, so as he should have. So
right, I would
good
agree.
Thing for Tippett is now that he's on the radar, it may be a little bit easier if he doesn't get in this year to keep him in the debate.
Good. Good.
And the flip side is this is a good year to get in. There are not a lot of lock candidates.
I would agree with that assessment, number one. Number two, how often does the Board of Selectors actually change over? Does a guy have to give up his seat, or does it actually rotate?
No, it doesn't rotate. You pretty much got to croak or, you move out of football, retire. Well, we got some guys in there, a couple guys that are retired and they're still on there.
Right. I did notice that.
Probably doesn't rotate as quickly as it should, Frank.
Right. Okay. Just curious. Thank you, Ron. I appreciate that, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot.
Great. Good talking to you, John.
You got it. You too. That's Ron Borges of the Boston Globe with us here inside Patriots Playbook. And, again, the breaking news today is that former Patriot linebacker Andre Tippett is now a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The announcement came right at a little less than a half an hour ago. And yeah, there you go. Way to go, Tip. He is one of 17 finalists.
This is Andre Tippett. That's not what we're looking for.
Oh, it is what we're looking for. We're looking for election to the Hall of Fame, baby. And, of course, as we mentioned, the Board of Selectors will meet the day before the Super Bowl down in Miami, the site of the Super Bowl, the day before the game on Saturday, February 3rd this year, and they will make their pitches. They'll make their spiels. Now, the Board of Selectors has one person from every league city, two in New York. They also have two veterans committee members, and they have seven at-large people. So you're looking at basically about 40 people in the room. That's what you're looking at, 40 people that are serving this Board of Selectors that ultimately will vote on who should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And if you've got a guy from your team, your city that's up, it's your responsibility to make the case. So it's going to be Ron's responsibility, again, to make the case for Andre Tippett to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So, hey, if you want to send him some suggestions, feel free to email him at the Globe. I'm sure he'll be glad to take it. I'm sure he'll take some good positive stuff, too, because I know a lot of fans disagree, generally speaking, with what Ron Borges had to say in many of his columns over the years of the Globe. And maybe you can give him some positive influence and some positive feedback, and maybe he'll hear you if that's indeed what you're looking for. All right, so there you go. I'm sorry we digressed just a little bit from the matchup, but I'm not sorry we digressed because it's a big day for Andre Tippett, and it's a big day for the Patriots football family, if you will, and really in Patriots history. You've only got two Patriots players who are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. You got just two. You got Hog Hannah, and you got Mike Haynes. That's it. That's all you got. And, of course, Mike Haynes, even though he was a Patriot, probably in there based on a lot of his play with the Raiders over the years. So, you know, that's all you got. So this is a big moment in Patriots football history. And I think most longtime, most savvy fans of the NFL certainly realize that while the Patriots may be one of the preeminent, if not the preeminent program here since the turn of the century, and the turn of the millennium in the NFL, that prior to 2000, actually, we go back to prior to 1993, before Bill Parcells actually arrived here in New England as head coach and began to turn the way of thinking around about this franchise struggled on and off of the field over a number of years, and the stories are certainly out there, and most of them are probably true, what you've heard of. There were only brief spots in the previous 46 years where, the Pats had any kind of success. You know, they had the Super Bowl in 85, and, you know, they had a couple of AFL championship game appearances and what have you. But other than that, this franchise wasn't largely successful. And so this is, you know, something that while we're used to it now, it's not something that in the overall scheme of things, in this 46, 47-year history now of this franchise, that we're in, you know, terribly used to. So it's a big moment, and we're proud of Andre Tippett, and hopefully we'll obviously wish him some good luck as the vote comes down. Let me sneak in a couple of emails here real quick, and then we're going to get off to the conference call so you can hear some of the analysis and the breakdown of how the Patriots match up specifically with the Chargers. We'll also include the other AFC divisional playoff, the semifinal, if you will, between the Colts and the Ravens. And that will come from Phil Sims, who will be calling the Patriots-Chargers game with Jim Nance this Sunday. And it will also come from Dan Dierdorf, who will be paired up with Bryant Gumbel from CBS Sports. So that's coming up here in just a minute or two. This email comes from Larry, who's in Santa Monica. And he says, John, we've been talking a lot about Brady and spreading wide, but Bill might go the other way. Chargers have been giving up a lot of rushing yards to different backs over the past few months. We might really go heavy here to start the game and take away Merriman the blitzer. Also, we have scored a lot of points since Miami's shutout, and we played a lot of tough, desperate teams down the stretch. Chargers have been beaching it. I won't terribly disagree with that, Larry, but I'll tell you, I'll be honest. I would be shocked if the Patriots didn't have about 10 to 20 plays of five receivers, empty backfield, shotgun, no huddle offense. Reason being is that you take a lot of that point of attack away from blitzing players like Sean Merriman might be, like a guy like Luis Castillo might be in particular. And so I think in order to neutralize them and to get them having to defend rather than attack, and I think we can all agree that attack is a better mode for those two guys in particular, I think I'd be stunned if we didn't see the Patriots go, you know, five wide, empty back, shotgun, no huddle, and do it for, you know, at least 10 to 20 plays. That would really surprise me. I do think that they'll pound, and I do think they'll run right at him, and, you know, I do think that there'll be some blocking help, and I do think, you know, provided he's healthy, you'll see Heath Evans, you'll see some three tight end sets, you know, you'll see a lot of that. But don't give up on the no huddle, five wide spread offense. It certainly worked this last week, against the Jets, and it worked the previous weeks as well leading into the playoffs. I think the Patriots will find that somehow in their playbook. Gabe in Pennsylvania says, John, just one thing the Pats must do? Well, you get the five standard answers. He says, one, stop Tomlinson, or at least slow him down. Two, pressure, sack, and force Rivers to make mistakes. Three, shut down Gates. Four, tackle. I can hear Lombardi now from that sound clip. Grab. What the hell is going on out here? Everybody's grabbing. Nobody's tackling. That's a good one. We should find that. That's an appropriate soundbite, Gabe. Thank you. And five, max protect Brady. Please keep steroid boy away from him. My answer, albeit obscure, is force Marty to play Marty ball. That is, score first, score quick, and make Marty go back to his old ways and, like, abandon the run. Okay, good points, Gabe. Thank you. Let's see. And he also sends this other quick note. He says, John, don't forget Nick Bonacani. So if you count Haynes, then that's three. That's true. Technically, Bonacani did play his first couple of years with the Patriots, and Bonacani is in the Hall of Fame. So, yeah, if you're counting former Patriots, Nick Bonacani will definitely make three. So thank you for pointing that out. Gabe is one of our better fans, and so it doesn't surprise me that he would come up with that. True. Three players in the Hall of Fame that wore Patriot jerseys. Two players primarily, though, that spent a good deal of their careers with New England. And obviously, one that we can consider a Patriot from start to finish, and that would be Hog Hannah. So, at any rate, yes, we do wish Andre Tippett good luck, because I think it's unanimous amongst Patriot fans, and certainly I think most that have covered the game, at least into the last 20 years, that Andre Tippett is worthy of Hall of Fame inclusion. So we'll leave it at that, and we'll bring you updates as they become available. All right, let's wrap up today's program. Oh, you want to stay tuned, though, because coming up shortly before 4 p.m., or right at about 4 p.m. Eastern time, which is in approximately 25 minutes from now, we'll get the updated injury report, because I know there are many of you that are wondering about Rodney Harrison and whether or not his chances are increasing or decreasing as the days go by this week to perhaps get some playing time against his former team, the Chargers, this Sunday. So we will bring you the very latest injury report today, and we'll read it to you, and then you can take it for what it's worth, because as you know, as we've spelled out on this program many times, I believe the injury report about as far as I could throw it. And I don't throw it very far. I don't have, you know, that kind of a gun. So, you know, I don't want to say that it's not truthful, but I just want to say that it's certainly general in regard. But, you know, hey, if he's listed as questionable as opposed to doubtful or out, then you'd have to say that's at least he's got a fighting chance. And I think that would be a great thing to see him make the return. Personally, I don't think it'll happen, but, hey, who knows? So we'll update that for you here coming up in about 20, 25 minutes. In the meantime, Phil Simms and Dan Dierdorf from CBS Sports on the AFC playoff games in a conference call.
Please stand by. Good day and welcome to this CBS Sports NFL Divisional Playoffs conference call. This call is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Robin Brindle. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today we have our lead NFL analyst Phil Simms and Dan Dierdorf, who will be calling
Well, Dan Dierdorf will be calling the Indianapolis-Baltimore game on Saturday at 4:30 with Greg Gumbel, and Phil Simms will be calling the New England-San Diego game on Sunday with Jim Nance at 4:30. It will all begin with the NFL Today at 3:30 both days. We're just going to go quickly right to Phil and Dan to do some opening remarks to talk about the NFL games, not only CBS, but you know, AFC, NFC. It's all wide open. Phil, you want to start?
I'll just say this. Let's just ask us some questions, and I'll answer those. But, you know, of course, I'm looking forward to the games, all the games, and especially mine out in San Diego. Just New England and San Diego sounds pretty good to me.
Well, what a spectacular weekend it is if you're an NFL football junkie, getting two games like we're going to have on Saturday and then two games on Sunday. Open the chips, get the six-pack, put your feet up, and don't plan on getting anything done Saturday and Sunday.
Are you telling us you drink, Dan? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
I am in a constant state of dehydration, and I've got to fix it.
need more cowbell.
My doctor tells me it's good for me.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, operator, I guess will you explain the electronic Q&A?
Yep. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment.
Boring.
Please press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment.
Easier to play defense at a high level every week than it is to play offense at that level every week, and I think history in the National Football League has borne that out. This matchup is such a contrast in styles in so many different ways. Both offenses, both defenses, I think, you know, if styles make bites, this has the makeup of a classic. It's the lightweight in the Colt, and I mean that physically. They're a smallish team going against one of the biggest, most physical teams in the game, and it's a real contrast in style.
You know, Mike, I'll say this. Dan's right. Defenses do not have big down weeks. Offenses can, because one thing goes wrong on offense, it kind of disrupts everything about the execution. Very few teams have tried to do it the way the Indianapolis Colts have done it, built through the quarterback and really put a lot of pressure on the offensive side of the ball to lead them to championships. And people always say to me, well, it hasn't worked. And my answer is, well, it might not have won the Super Bowl yet for the Indianapolis Colts, but look at all the tremendous years they have had, how close they have been. So I always go, why haven't more teams trying to do? Why haven't they tried to duplicate what the Colts have done? And that's the big thing. You know, defenses, like I said, they down weeks, they can still win a game for you. Where an offense has a down week, they're usually going to lose. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, and our next question comes from Bill Doyle with Worcester Telegram.
Yes, Phil, I was wondering, much has been made about Belichick's and Schottenheimer's records during the playoffs. How important do you think they are, or will this game come down to the players, not the coaches?
Well, you probably, if you think it's the players, you're probably asking the wrong guy and me, because I'm one of the few people, yes, I know you need good players. I mean, we all know that. No matter how much you coach a jackass to run, he's still not going to win the Kentucky Derby. And so you need players. But I believe the NFL is about coaches who have that great ability to create environments, to put players in the right position to have success. And, you know, Dan looks back at his career when they were rocking and rolling in St. Louis on the offensive side. They had some guys over there that could coach it up. I know they had good players, too. And I look at the Giants, just when I played. Well, hell, everybody on that coaching staff is now somebody, done something good, been somewhere in the NFL, so that has something to do with it, too. And they're both tremendous coaches, and I really believe that strategy will be a very big part in the outcome of this game. Because physically, I don't see tremendous mismatches where one team can just say, we're going to come out and dominate you this way. So kind of like that game we saw last night. Coaching had a little to do with the outcome there. I know there were some great players, but I think the style of play that is put into this game is going to determine who's going to win.
So should the Patriots have the edge because of Belichick's coaching record in the playoffs?
He's had tremendous success, but, it's a new year, and teams are different. Marty's a different coach. This team, the San Diego Chargers, have a little bit of a different personality than you've seen with typical Marty Schottenheimer teams. He's not afraid to open it up. The defense is not they're not predictable. They'll take chances with Wade Phillips. So, it's a big story. Everybody talks about it. I'll talk about it a lot in the game this week. I'll ask Marty a lot of questions, too. I just think to say, oh, New England's got a huge advantage because Bill Belichick's won more playoff games, I don't know if I would go that far and say that.
Thanks.
And our next question is from Jerry Green from Orlando Centennial.
Guys, for both of you, let's cut to the chase on the AFL and the NFL and the NFC. Excuse me. Right now, would you take any of the surviving AFC teams to beat any of the surviving NFC teams?
Yes, I would. I can't. I don't know that whomever represents the NFC and you look at the class over there and you think about Chicago and New Orleans, I would assume that both of them would be an underdog to whichever of the four teams from the AFC would make it to the Super Bowl. That's my guess. I'm not a handicapper, and that's not what I do for a living, but that'd be my guess.
Jerry, I'm not going to make any predictions. I'm doing the games. I'm doing the Super Bowl. So, players, I've learned players and coaches and organizations, they hate it when you predict, and especially when you predict against them. And that's what I'm not about. I analyze it, I hope, when you watch it on Sundays. But when you do look at the AFC teams overall, it's harder to pick the weaknesses of those teams than it is when you look at the NFC. So, that's what I kind of look at. The fewer weaknesses you have, well, doesn't that tell you that the greater your chances of winning are? So that's kind of what I see right now with most of the AFC teams compared to the NFC.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And our next question is from Shireen Williams from Fort Worth Star.
Hi, this is for Phil and Dan. Marty Schottenheimer said over and over that he thinks LaDainian Tomlinson is the best running back he's ever seen. I just want to know from you guys what you think right now, where LaDainian Tomlinson's mark is in history at this point.
Go ahead, Dan.
All right, I'll start with that. And Marty should back his guy, and LaDainian Tomlinson is having a phenomenal season. And what he's doing is historic. And anytime anyone rewrites a record book, you do have to maybe sit back and have that conversation. Where does he rank among the all-time greatest that have played this game? I always thought that Jim Brown was the best running back I ever saw. I always thought that he was the best football player I ever saw. Lawrence Taylor made me rethink that a little bit and thinking, well, geez, I think Lawrence Taylor was the equal of Jim Brown as far as being a football player, not just a specific positional player. In my mind, Jim Brown is still the best running back that I think ever carried a football in the National Football League. But let's face it, this is so subjective.
It is, and Dan took a lot of words right out of my mouth. I grew up, my first impressions of pro football were Jim Brown. Living in Louisville, Kentucky, Cleveland Browns football games were on every Sunday. And, LaDainian Tomlinson, I've probably paid more attention to him this year than ever, and I think I recognize and even understand more what Marty Schottenheimer is saying, that I see things that do make him truly a great player. The word great's thrown out there way too often, but he is. But the errors, when you talk about it, why it's so subjective, think about when Jim Brown played. Well, it was the same formation by the offense almost every single play of the game. Now LaDainian Tomlinson and all the runners here in the last 5, 10, 15 years, they're playing in offenses that spread out, create all kinds of other avenues, and I think they make it somewhat easier for running backs to set numbers, to score touchdowns than it has in the past. And we're seeing more, and LaDainian Tomlinson is taking advantage of whatever you want to call it, the new age of football, the way it's looked upon, and the style of runner who is having success now, where back when I grew up and Dan's a little older, that it was more the Jim Brown type of running back who were, well, you know, I agree with Dan. I look at Jim Brown as still maybe the greatest player to ever play football, period.
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing, and I know I speak for Phil when I say this. It is so pleasing when you get an opportunity to get to know these players over the years, because you sit down and you visit with them and you get to know them a little bit. And what a delight it has been from the first time that we had an opportunity to sit with LT when he was a rookie. He leaves the room and you sit there and you talk about, is that for real? Is he really that nice of a guy? And then to find out over the years that, yes, he really is that much of a quality human being. And I don't think that can be said enough about what a good guy he is, Phil.
Yeah, very well said, Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Shereen.
And our next question is Jim Williams with Washington Examiner.
Thanks. Guys, Phil, from a quarterbacking standpoint, Dan, from an offensive line standpoint, when you see a defense that's been as dominant as Baltimore has been, are there ways to exploit the speed that they have?
Well, you always try to exploit speed, and you do that with misdirection, quarterback keeps, whatever, because you want to slow them down, make them think, and all that stuff. That's always. And I think also from the quarterback perspective, you know, you got to go in when you play the Baltimore Ravens and realize that it is different, that the environment you're going to play in is entirely different. And it makes me think of when I was a quarterback and I played so many years against Reggie White and Buddy Ryan and that Eagles defense. Well, you know, I knew when we played them that it was going to be ugly. My numbers, even if I played really well, were not going to be pleasing to look at. And it was more about just going out and fighting and just really grinding and trying to be tough and win it more that way than saying it's going to be, oh, I'm going to throw over here and I'm going to do this and isn't it going to be pretty? Well, it's not going to be pretty. Even for Peyton Manning, for as great as he is, and their offense is so dynamic, it will not be pretty for them either. And I think you've got to accept that. And a lot of times I think athletes and people, that's hard to accept. But, you know, the one thing, the Colts, they've had a little success. They did last year opening game, I think it was, when they played. So they got a good understanding what they're going up against.
Phil's right about it's never pretty playing Baltimore. And a lot of times it's downright ugly because you're getting your nose rubbed in it. This is a team that prides itself on pressure, that they can get to the quarterback, that they can rattle the quarterback. And when they operate out of that 3-4 front of theirs and they're able to put such pressure on the edges, and that kind of pressure has bothered Peyton Manning before. And again, I think for the Colts, it's really simple. Can they somehow try to replicate the way they play at home on the road? They've lost their last four games on the road. They are oftentimes a totally different team when they have to go on the road, and any kind of a performance like that in Baltimore on Saturday, it could be really ugly for the Colts. They can't afford to play sloppy football.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
And our next question is Michael Love with Orange County Register.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Michael. Fine, thanks.
Couple questions for you. The first one, either one can handle, Dan, Phil. The Colts have kind of lower expectations this year coming into the playoffs. You know, they were the top seed a year ago. It's kind of similar in some ways to what happened to Pittsburgh, where they were 15-1 and then they lose and then they come in as a wild card. Do you think that makes a difference in how a team goes through this thing, that maybe they have less pressure on them a little bit because the expectations are lowered?
Well, you know, Dan, I'll answer first, I guess, Dan.
Sure.
I'm curious to hear what you have to say. And, you know, maybe from the public and media, but inside that locker room, I promise you, the expectations and all that are off the charts. They might say, well, this is just a different way. Sometimes, and, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about it, just thought about this, is that players nowadays, and I know the Colts have lost the last four in a row, but they like it when they're up against it. You know, Dan, I don't know how you were when you remember when you played, but there's nothing like running out onto the field in the opposing, you know, when you're away. When they yell at you and they curse at you and all that, it really did something to me, and I loved it. And it kind of bands you together. And, you know, you look at the Colts, they had that one bad game, but, you know, they have fought hard on the road. They play everybody close. And I'm sure a lot of those feelings are going to be there for them. You cannot get those feelings when you're at home because you run out and, well, if you're lucky, they cheer for you, you know, but it's not always that way as a quarterback. But, and, you know, it's, you just can't, bond together. And that'll be, I think, a big thing for the Colts this week. But I know this, talking to Tony Dungy, I did a couple of the games late in the year. The expectations there, they're as great as they've ever been. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I agree with Phil wholeheartedly, and it's funny to hear you say that, Phil. In many ways, I like going on the road more than I like playing at home. You had fewer distractions. I liked being isolated, being in the hotel with my teammates, and sometimes it was easier than everything that came with playing a home game. So professionals being on the road from a psychological standpoint doesn't really bother them. The reality is, though, over the course of time, you do build up a history. And like it or not, the Colts have built a history of not playing as well outside of the RCA Dome as they do playing inside of it. That, after a while, that becomes reality, and for the Colts, that is their reality.
Yeah, you know, Dan, and what people don't, and I always say this, remember, you got 8 games at home a year, so they constructed their team to be good at home. Speed on defense, they play in a dome, they know crowd noise is a factor, they do it with offense, so they got the perfect environment, they don't have to worry about weather. So it just stands to reason, of course they're not going to be as good on the road, but you know, they still hope they're good enough to overcome some of the obstacles we talked about.
For the Colts, I think it's really simple. The difference between this year and last has been their offensive production this year. They haven't scored. They haven't gotten out to the big leads. They haven't taken the pressure off of their defense this year the way they did last year. So, conversely, their defensive numbers this year are much poorer than they were a year ago. Everybody knows how people have run the ball. You know, this is a team that's given up 173 yards a game rushing. That's a staggering number. And because of that, they're not as effective as getting to the quarterback. This, you know, I don't want to bore you with numbers, but they had 25 sacks this year defensively. A year ago, they had 46. Now, that is a huge drop-off in production. And that's mostly, in my mind, Phil, because offensively, they weren't as dominant this year.
Oh, absolutely. And everybody plays them a different way.
Yeah.
As Dwight Freeney said to me 2 weeks ago, they were playing the Miami Dolphins. Oh, come on, Phil. They're not going to pass. They're afraid. Come on, you know what I know. They won't throw. And, you know, so they know what they're up against. Teams are changing the way they play the Indianapolis Colts, and that's had a big effect on their season, too.
One additional question for you, Phil. I remember, this is a different subject, it's a Drew Brees-related question. I remember at the time that he suffered that injury, you had said that you had suffered a similar one and it wasn't that bad. But still, I think a lot of people were surprised that Drew Brees was able to come back in the manner that he did with a shoulder injury, going into a new situation, a lot of new teammates. How impressed were you with the season that he put together?
Well, very, of course. You know, I followed him closely. I watched him during the preseason, and I thought physically, I said, wow, I was very, I said, there's trouble. He physically didn't, to me, look like he was ready. And, of course, he wasn't. And they started the season out, and they kind of went along, and I think, you know, I noticed it, and I thought it was dramatic. I thought he, as the games went along, he started throwing the ball better and better. And I don't know when it was. I was watching the game. It was week six, week eight. And he threw a couple of passes, and I went, wow, that's the best I've ever seen Drew Brees' arm look ever, ever. And so the rehab and,
That, of course, Phil Simms and Dan Dierdorf from CBS Sports in a conference call earlier here that was recorded at Gillette Stadium talking about this weekend's NFL playoff games in the divisional round. We're going to put the wraps on this on today's Patriots playbook by giving you the update on the Patriots injury report. Rodney Harrison has been listed as out for the game on Sunday. I can't say that that certainly comes as a great surprise. I think there was at least a little bit of hope that he might be able to somehow get his way on there, but he had not been in practice today and was really, I don't think, was expected anyway. So Harrison is definitely out for this Sunday. You have three players listed as questionable: Bam Childress, Heath Evans, and Benjamin Watson. In particular, Childress and Watson were questionable last week but played. And then four probables: Brady, Ellis Hobbs, Richard Seymour, Mike Vrabel. Brady, Hobbs, and Seymour all were at practice and practiced the entire time today. Childress, Evans, Watson, and Vrabel all missed a small portion of practice today, and that is the update. Don't have anything yet from the Chargers, but then again, because of the time difference, they're probably they won't release it until after their practice is done. So there's the latest from the Patriots on the injury report. Tomorrow's program, you want to be here for that, because it'll be action-packed, and it will be jammed completely full of great things. Tomorrow, Michael Felger from 890 ESPN in Boston and the Boston Herald will be here with us for a brief while during the course of the program, and so we'll get his insight on the matchup coming up on Sunday. We'll also have Russell Baxter, who normally joins us on Thursday. He's the NFL research coordinator for ESPN. He'll be a part of the program tomorrow. We may have the conference calls for you, certainly from Marty Schottenheimer. And I'm not sure, do we even know who the Chargers player was today? We think it was Sean Merriman, but nevertheless, we should have that for you. And yes, we can get to Tom Brady tomorrow as well. So we'll be chock full of things to get to tomorrow. You won't want to miss out as we count it down to kickoff. Patriots at the Chargers this next Sunday.
Breaks the tackle, drives it upfield to the 10, to the 5.